Hi everyone, this is Shai Danon here from Raising the Frequency from Israel, and today I have a really good friend, and it's been a while since we had the chat, and many things have happened in reality since we met and since we spoke, and he was also in Israel, and we're going to speak now with Dr. Laszlo Boros. He's also a professor, but anyway, it's not something that he considers much, especially not when he speaks with me. We're going to welcome Dr. Laszlo Boros from Hungary, a specialist in the deuterium depletion. And he will probably will tell you much better about himself than me. But the subject for today is deuterium depleting natural ketosis in strength and performance. So let's just do this and come back. Laszlo, my friend, how are you?
I'm good. How are you, Shai?
I'm good. It's always good to see you and to hear you. Exactly. And this laughter, you see, I miss the laughter.
Thank you so much for inviting me. And indeed, it's an interesting topic for everyone.
My pleasure. Always my pleasure, actually. Tell me, before we dive in into what you prepared for us today, maybe just for those who don't know you, just maybe briefly or not. I mean, you can take as much time as you like, just to share with us about your expertise, about your knowledge, your field of, you know, what you've been doing in the last few years. I know you've been changing also your doing since the Corona BS, etc. So who are you, Laszlo Boros? What is it that you do and specialize in? Just so the audience who don't know you get to know you a bit. Thanks.
Thank you so much. So I am a doctor of medicine or medical doctor. I finished medical school in 1987 in Szeged, Hungary. That's where Albert Szentgyörgyi did research on biological oxidation and vitamin C and fumarate hydratase, which is a Krebs cycle enzyme. And he was given the Nobel Prize in 1937 in medicine and physiology. And so I graduated from the same medical school, and then after a short time of a fellowship with the Hungarian Academy of Sciences, I first moved to Germany, then I moved to the United States in 1991. And I was a research scientist at the Ohio State University until 1998, when in September I joined the University of California, Los Angeles, or UCLA, and I was climbing up to professorship in 2017 and of pediatrics, and I retired in 2021, and ever since I do mostly editorial work. I do work on deuteronomics, which is the science of deuterium regulation, how deuterium is regulated in the human body. And I write papers, review and edit papers as well, but I also write papers, which is the topic today I would like to cover, of a new publication regarding physical challenges, strength and performance based on nutritional and deuterium depleting nutritional protocols and lifestyle, which I would recommend everybody who is interested in sports and medicine and strength and health and so on to check it out. But we'll cover that in detail. And I do a lot of research on deuterium content of food, health-related issues based on nutrition, lifestyle, and exposure to various environmental factors involving, including diet, light, exercise, and pollutants and toxins and so on. And I also work with water drinking protocols, how much water, when, and what to drink. If it's necessary to drink because somebody is thirsty. So pretty much this is like my background and my current activity. And I do appreciate the fact that you do run these podcasts and you give opportunities to faculty and audiences, past faculty, retired faculty at major academic institutions who couldn't fit the academics or was not willing to comply with academics rules, which are really not to serve free science, but mostly to serve business and pharmaceutical operations. So I didn't want those. And I'm very happy to talk about deuteronomics, which is more like in an integrative medical arena. And I'm glad we can publish papers in this direction and we can edit papers that promote and kind of summarize these results.
Excellent, thank you. By the way, are you still going to give lectures? I mean, when you invited, obviously, you give lectures in institutions or in places like around the world, or are you still doing that?
Yeah, I do give lectures, but mostly I do podcasts because somehow meetings now are replaced by podcasts and conversations online, appearances and opportunities. So it's changing, but I do give talks, invited talks, and I do give podcasts. In the last 3-4 months, I did maybe 6 or 7 podcasts. And so do my colleagues, Dr. Stephanie Sennett, for example, who is working on glyphosate. And we are joining efforts just to promote deuteronomics research in various medical fields, including toxicology and so on.
Excellent. Just like before we dive in, I should say that, you know, myself and my wife, we were vegan, let's say, for 20 years, more or less. And since, let's say, 6 years or so, since basically around the time you were here, yeah, we started to shift back, I should say, to what my wife calls it source nutrition, okay? Which for me, it's more, or it's closer to what my grandparents used to eat, you know, even in Bulgaria, not even here in Israel, okay? When my mom grew up, when my dad grew up as children, they, in Bulgaria, they used to eat whatever vegetables they were there according to the seasons. They used to eat eggs. They used to eat butter. They used to drink milk from the, you know, straight from the cow. They used to eat meat, which is obviously grass-fed because it was not industrialized back then, at least not in Bulgaria. I make my own bread nowadays. I eat, you know, like a proper cabbage, that fermented cabbage and fermented cereals, and everything that we eat, almost everything that we eat is fermented. So it's with proper bacteria. So my wife calls it like source nutrition. But actually, when I think about it, this is quite simple, and it's what people or humanity, depends where they live on the planet, but they used to eat this food for centuries until the last few decades that veganism has raised its head and was pushed as part of the propaganda. And it seems like nowadays there's like going back, you know, leaving the veganism and this sort of diet. And I don't tell anyone what to eat. Yeah, I'm just saying this, what I see that is happening. People are going back to eat proper food. And I say proper food because that's the highest nutritional value that I can find. And it seems like the fields of, and I'm saying fields, not just one field, but fields of science that you dance between, and especially what you specialized in, verifying that this food, the source food, the source nutrition, is the best available for performance, for mitochondria functioning in the body. And this is amazing. For me, it's amazing because, I mean, I've been knowing it for a few years now, since, let's say, you were here in Israel and the podcast we did back then. But since then, it just, I get stronger and stronger in it. You know, I even reduced weight thanks to a few months I'm in this nutrition. And I wasn't fat, but, you know, I'm 52, 53 years old soon. And, you know, metabolism is not the same. But actually, it's better now. I mean, since few months, I've been strictly on this diet and my metabolism is excellent. And I feel energized and everything is good, you know, knock on wood.
I'm sure you put on again your high school graduation suit. Because I can.
Yes. So it's
I'm 74, 75 kilograms, and I was 70, 72 when I was in high school. So wow. Yeah, back in all wow. ages.
Wow. Yeah, you, I know. You also, you don't drink water. I mean, when you were here in Israel, and I've been telling people about that I remember I gave you as a gift olive oil, and because that's your water. I mean, when thirst arises, so you don't drink immediately, you wait. And then if you're still thirsty, you take a sip of olive oil. And I keep reminding people that, you know, I ask people what the camel on its back, what he has on its back. And people say water. And I'm like, no, camel don't have water on his back. He has fat. And that's how he makes water, or mitochondria makes water from fat in the body. So please take us, you know, to this this fascinating field of nutrition and food. But it's not just about that. It's about how the body really works, and how it makes energy, and how it makes water, and what we need to feed the body in order for it to work in the best way it can. How we do it?
I'll tell you how on this, how like off scale we are. I usually, when the circus is around, they have camels, and the caretakers, they always have a big barrel of water next to the camels. Mm-hmm. Because of the animal rights activists. So I always ask the guy with the camel, like, how much they drink of it. And they say, well, they never drink it. So especially in the bread. But you have to still put the water, because the animal activists, they don't understand what they are asking for, because camels actually eat their water and store their water in the form of fat, meaning that they produce fat from the grass that they eat, and that's their water. So, and we are able to do the same. I drink only water when I'm thirsty, and I only drink as much as needed to kill my thirst. I have a espresso coffee in the morning if I feel like, and for days sometimes it's my water intake. If I'm thirsty and it's not going away, then I would drink as much as necessary. It's always the 2 liters of water, like recreational, 125, 105 ppm. But indeed, that's the bottom line, is that that's the fundamental information and knowledge behind this approach, and keep my weight at high school and feel strong and healthy. Is, and my blood pressure is 120 over 80. My pulse rate is 52 per minute. So without medications of any sort, if I go to a high school reunion, I'm the single one who is not taking almost. I don't remember anyone else who would not need any medication and would actually keep their high school weight and body structure composition, but seems like this diet that you mentioned is the key to preserve all that. Hmm.
Amazing. I mean, I know many people, like in Israel, over the internet, the social networks, they commenting about, again, they were vegans, it didn't do them any good. And to be honest, some vegans, they don't eat properly. I mean, they eat processed vegan food, which is not food at all. I mean, if anything, then you know, eat some green leaves, which is low in deuterium as well, and eat some proper nuts and avocado and olive oil, like the fatty food, then you get something. But otherwise, all the carbs and all this, it just
backfire. Yeah.
Weaker. Yes, it makes you weaker. Exactly.
Yeah. So this is the study that we did, which we will cover in a minute. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah. I want to actually to jump into that because I got via email the last paper you published, and about climbing the Everest without extra oxygen, and this was quite fascinating because obviously whoever goes and climb on the Everest, he needs some extra oxygen because we know that there's not enough oxygen in the high levels, the higher you climb. But actually you manage somehow, if you can explain it, because it's mind-boggling how one can do it, how we can climb to Mount Everest with no extra oxygen. I mean, what the how?
Yeah, there are climbers. There are actually less than 200 people who managed to climb up to the Mount Everest and come back alive from the Mount Everest, which is over 8,000 some 50 meters or some sort. So it's almost, I would say, 9,000 meters high, and a little bit short of that, but simply because the oxygen pressure is so low, it's about one third of what you have at sea level, that the oxygen exchange in the lungs to the capillaries become very slow. And for that reason, climbers cannot maintain sufficient energy production in their cells, especially muscle cells, especially when they have to climb. And that requires exercise with some heavy gear and shoes, and because it's also cold and icy, and carry some equipment. So it's I would say when it comes to physical challenges, climbing up to the Mount Everest is probably one of the most, I would say, requiring physical, most demanding physical challenge. But a few people can actually do going up and down without supplemental oxygen. And that counts as a lifetime performance or a lifetime achievement, and only a few people could do that. Unfortunately, many people die who experience with this without additional or extra oxygen. But if you can actually switch to the right diet, which we're going to cover in this conversation, then you can actually climb up to the Mount Everest without supplemental oxygen and come back alive. And this is what is discussed in the paper, how this is possible. And the case study for this biochemical argument that we're going to go through here is Mr. Ballinger, who actually climbed with success up to the Mount Everest in 2017 and came back alive, and he had to use oxygen in every previous attempt, or he had to turn around simply because he couldn't make it up there, and he was afraid that he was going to get himself killed while he was on carbohydrate and carbohydrate or plant-based diets. And
very quickly, Laszlo, I'm just sharing the paper published in Science Direct, okay? It was published on April 24,
The paper was published in February, I believe.
February, okay. And it says here, summiting Mount Everest in deuterium depleting nutritional ketosis without supplemental oxygen.
That's the time.
Yes, just to show that there is a paper and we are speaking about that. All right, go ahead, please. Yes.
I'm glad we could publish this paper because one of the co-authors is from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, the Vrije Universiteit, and from the University of Debrecen, Hungary. So it's a international team of investigators and biochemists who actually could detail or solve the question of what is the reason, what's behind success after turning around six times or using oxygen to go up to the Mount Everest. So what is the key to actually being able to perform this for a climber or a sportsman who had to turn around or had to use oxygen six times in previous attempts? And it seems that the key to make this switch is related to metabolism, and more specifically, it's related to dieting. And with carnivore dieting or eating a ketogenic, fat-burning, preferentially grass-fed meat and fat source, made this climber, Mr. Ballinger, able to climb up to the Mount Everest without supplemental oxygen. Now, we have to be aware of that when you make those decisions to actually climb up to the Mount Everest, you pretty much on your own, simply because the very limited resources. So your mental fitness, so it's not only physical fitness that we are talking about here, but also mental fitness to make very critical life-saving decisions to keep going, climbing or turn around, simply based on how you feel. And what Mr. Ballinger described when he had to turn around on carbohydrate, plant-based diets, that means pizza dough, pizza, Nutribars, protein bars, energy drinks, and all the baloney that sports people believe in, and supplements, we don't, those are actually not helping when it comes to top performances. So what happened is that Mr. Ballinger was asking climbers who could actually climb up to the Mount Everest. One of his friends did it. And so he was asking what is exactly what they are doing. And they were actually just telling them this was actually a diet-related issue, meaning that they had to be fat burners to be able to climb up to the Mount Everest. And changing to a ketogenic diet, which only allows less than 10% carbohydrates and the rest is pretty much animal fat and plant fat, avocados and nuts and so on, what you mentioned, he was able to do that with ease, meaning that was no challenging after all to climb up to the Mount Everest. So the biochemical background is what is interesting to scientists, and this is why we wrote this paper, to see how mitochondrial function and how fat oxidation can fulfill all the energy requirements and all the fitness and mental ability to make very critical decisions at high altitudes in mountains, which are actually deadly situations because of the limited oxygen pressure up there. So if you want to share the paper, do you have any questions or you're good?
The paper or the picture that you want
to share? The picture that I put up there. And I only see my computer, so I don't see what's in the podcast, but
but we see the picture. It's on the screen.
It's on the screen. Okay. Yes. So here you can see a cell. Let's say this is a muscle cell. And it has two organelles shown. One is the mitochondria. It's to the right. It's mm-hmm. shown in green. And mm-hmm. we cover mitochondria so many times in podcasts, but to be able to explain how climbing up to Mount Everest is possible based on ketogenic diet, we have to include another cell organelle in this scenario. It's called peroxisomes, It's yellow. It's to the left. Mm-hmm. And say it again.
Yeah. I'm listening. Yeah.
We look. Can you see him?
Yes.
Okay. So practically these two organelles, cell organelles, work like a hybrid engine in, or a dual mode engine in our system. Peroxisomes to the left are the diesel part of our engine, and the mitochondria to the right are the gasoline type of engine. And these two engines have to work together, meaning that they have to oxidize various substrates to be able to climb up to the Mount Everest. So you need to imagine this as like you have a car which has a double engine compartment. One part burns gasoline, that's mitochondria, and the other one burns diesel fuel, and that's to the left. Both engines have their own advantage of being able to oxidize hydrocarbons or burn hydrocarbons and share those products in and between to be able to bring out the full energy resources, the full energy scale, the full energy that can be gained from hydrocarbons. Hydrocarbons are fuels, fat for that matter. And to be able to use these engines while climbing is key to be able to perform at high altitudes because of how these engines operate. Let's talk about peroxisomes first, which are to the left. And those are the cell organelles that prepare energy and prepare substrates for mitochondria to be able to further oxidize and gain energy from them. To the left, with the peroxisomes, you can see this big letter A on top. It's red. And you can see the very long chain fatty acids, the VSCFAs, those are abbreviations, and the branched chain fatty acids, which may have odd carbons, that actually enter peroxisomes. Now, very long chain fatty acids are coming from animal fat. We are talking about anything longer than palmitic acid or palmitate, which is a 16-carbon fatty acid. We don't consider palmitate a very long-chain fatty acid. We consider it a long-chain or medium, between medium and long-chain fatty acids. And peroxisomes can actually oxidize longer chains, 20, 22, 24, 26, and as long as necessary, as long as fatty acids are available in animal fat diet. And actually, they can do two things with these fatty acids. They can oxidize the beta carbon, which means that they generate shorter chain acyl coenzyme A's or fatty acids, and also acetyl coenzyme A, which is the substrate for mitochondria to gain metabolic water from, or the shortest ketone body for that matter. And the longer chains can be further modified to make shorter chains, palmitate, myristate, 16, 14 carbons that can actually enter mitochondria and get completely oxidized in mitochondria for that matter. So peroxisomes are more like a fat remodeling kind of fuel preparing organelles for mitochondria. But in the meantime, they also produce two very important substrates for mitochondrial metabolism. One is shorter chain fatty acids, and you can see that with the letter C on top. and you can also see NADH, the letter C on the bottom, which is a reduced NAD that can be transferred. The proton of this NAD can be transferred to the mitochondria, and mitochondria can use these protons coming from peroxisomes to generate ATP and to generate metabolic water from it. Now, in the meantime, you can see, and as fatty acids come in, letter B is in peroxisomes, show that peroxisomes work with O2 or oxygen gas or dissolved oxygen in your bloodstream. So there's no hemoglobin that is needed to supply oxygen for peroxisomes. And it's also interesting that the product of this oxidation of fatty acids is actually hydrogen peroxide. You can see this with the letter B, H2O2. And there's no ATP that is generated in peroxisomes, but a very valuable intermediate hydrogen peroxide is produced. And from two molecules of hydrogen peroxide, H2O2, mitochondria can produce a water molecule, and it can also recycle oxygen. So it is practically a very critical step in understanding how oxygen, dissolved oxygen in the blood, when oxygen pressure is not very high, is still able to supply peroxisomes with oxygen to oxidize fatty acids, and why fatty acids need to be in your nutrition and also in your bloodstream during climb to produce this energy, 188 kilojoule per mole energy in the form of heat when hydrogen peroxide is produced from oxygen and fatty acid protons. So this diesel compartment of your cellular energy producing system is able to produce energy without spark plugs or without activating oxygen. So it's not an innate oxygen. It's not O, but it's O2. It's oxygen gas, which is dissolved in your bloodstream, meaning that availability of it, it's unlimited simply because our air contains about 21% of oxygen, O2 gas in our air that surrounds us. So peroxisomes are very, very critical for high altitude and for energy production when energy is in demand. It's also very important to know about peroxisomes is that they only have one membrane. They don't have two membranes like mitochondria do. So they cannot really produce proton clouds to run those ATP synthase nanomotors. Those are proteins that produce ATP in our system. And this is why peroxisomes cannot produce ATP. They can only prepare fatty acids for mitochondrial oxidation, and they can only produce hydrogen peroxide for metabolic water production by catalase in mitochondria. And so these are the very essential roles of peroxisomes. Now, as long as your fatty acid is natural grass-fed source, then your peroxisome will produce hydrogen peroxide, which is low in deuterium. So as long as you eat natural habitat, grass-fed, pasture-raised, animal, lamb, cows, anything, goats, anything you kind of desire in that realm, and mountain goats, that's what the Sherpas eat, who have these climbers. They live around 5,000-6,000 meters altitude with their dogs, and they are just fine living their entire life up at high altitudes. But practically here, what you can see is that there's a sharing of responsibilities from between peroxisome and mitochondria to produce the force energy necessary to overcome these challenges, especially at high altitudes. Go ahead.
Laszlo, quick question. You mentioned the importance of grass-fed meat in order for the peroxisomes to produce properly, to prepare properly for the mitochondria. The thing is, what if someone is not eating grass-fed meat? I mean, how important it is for energy production or for the metabolic water, how important it is to have grass-fed or not grass-fed? If you can
Yeah, it's critically important, and you know why. If you eat a fat source that is grain fat, farm-raised animals, and who knows what else they eat, they have protein supplements, they don't eat grass, they are fed with China artificial cow feed, or who knows what they actually, in the U.S., they grind in the Halloween candies that they couldn't sell in the stores around Halloween time. So they feed these cows with any junk that is available, unfortunately. And that fat is going to be high in deuterium. And since peroxisomes take in either low or high deuterium fatty acids for modifications and for oxidation, the metabolic water or the metabolic hydrogen peroxide that they produce could be high in deuterium if not the grass-fed animal fat source is consumed. So those products will damage mitochondria fundamentally, meaning that it does matter where your fat is coming from, and it has to be grass-fed for the system to operate at optimal rate. And non-grass-fed, artificial, grain-fed, artificial meaning that it's not the natural food of the cow that they feed them in farms and so on, and various supplements and antibiotics, you know the list. Your peroxisomes are not able to differentiate between low and high deuterium fatty acids. So they produce whatever hydrogen peroxide is the result of the fat and the deuterium content of the fat. The hydrogen peroxide is going to match the deuterium content of the fat anyone consumes, and high deuterium in hydrogen peroxide or metabolic water after catalase reaction could damage mitochondria significantly, so it can compromise ATP synthesis. And go ahead.
So would it be true to say that if I cannot get hold of a grass-fed animal or meat, would I rather eat avocado?
Well, you can eat avocado for a certain period of time, but you're also going to need certain proteins and amino acids and meat and salt to actually supply your metabolism more thoroughly, meaning that if you don't have grass-fed animal or cow source, then you have to go and find one.
Yeah, because I know I'm asking because, for example, in Israel, you don't get, most of the animals or the meat that you can buy is not grass-fed. I mean, it's really, really rare to find grass-fed animals in Israel.
You need to go to a kosher butcher who actually, because kosher cow is probably the best.
No, but the kosher stamp here in Israel, it's got nothing to do with grass-fed. Okay, it's too separate. I mean, most people in Israel, they don't look for grass-fed. That therefore, the industry does not provide. I mean, there's no inclination, there's no urge to provide grass-fed products or animals to the population.
Well, if it's a real kosher butcher, then they even check the quality of the grass that those animals are eating. I'm talking about a religious kosher approach.
Yeah, I tell you, they don't bother about it. I mean, hopefully you are right, but from what I know, no one is doing it here in Israel. I speak with the growers. I speak with the farmers themselves who actually give grass to the cows. I mean, let's say most of the year the cows eat, obviously, outside. They're outside all year, and they're eating grass that is growing most of the year. And when there's no grass, I mean, it's dry, let's say in the summer, the cows or the animals, they still get the grass that the farmer has grown, the grass just for them, I mean, to feed them. So, and that's where I get my meat from, okay? So I make sure I speak with the farmer, not just with the butcher, but I speak with the actual farmer to know what's going on. Does he give injections? Which injections? Mm-hmm. How many times a year? Mm-hmm. What the cows eat all year round, not just in mm-hmm. the winter when it's easy to give grass to the cows, you know? Mm-hmm. And do they stay indoors, outdoor? Do they get their sun properly? You know, we need that mm-hmm. as well. So mm-hmm. after doing all this investigation into this area, only then I decide if I buy this meat or not, you know? And as I said, sure. it's really difficult in Israel to find grass-fed meat. I hope that after a podcast like that and other people who are waking up to the importance of... it's not just... You see, it's not just the nutritional value of the food. That's what I'm getting. It's not just the chemistry, but it's the biochemistry. It's the energy production of our body from the food it eats or from the food we give the body. And that makes a difference because people say, yes, you can get, let's say, you can get amino acids from a vegan diet and you can get amino acids from carnivore diet. But they're not the same in terms of energy production for the mitochondria. It's totally, it's two different things.
It's because of the deuterium content is vastly different. And what matters here is the deuterium content of the fat.
The fat, yes.
Because fatty acids don't go through a process called glycolysis that removes all potential deuterium and all hydrogens and protons from carbohydrates just to preserve mitochondria. Fat, your cells expect that fat can only come from animal, grass-fed animal source. So your cells don't bother to deuterate or remove deuterium from fatty acids because by default, your cells think that if it's fatty acids, circulating fatty acids, that have to come from your diet. And your diet is made of natural grass-fed food source. Our cells have not caught up yet with the food industry and refined food and high fructose corn syrup and all that junk that actually, you know, produce high fat, high deuterium fat in any species that consume those. Obviously, they become obese, they grow very fast. Economically, those are very feasible because you can kind of just trade their meat in department stores and you can just feed a lot of people with them, but that's not nutrition. It's practically just eating industrial junk. Yeah. And they should be paying people to remove that junk after all, but practically this is how it goes. It's cheaper indeed, and you name it. But practically, to preserve this system that we are talking about, the peroxisomes and the mitochondria, you need low deuterium, grass-fed, natural animal based nutrition. Mostly you can eat some plants which are high in fat moderately, or when it's necessary, or when you desire. Avocados, certain nuts may be good for that purpose, but the majority of your food should be composed of a carnivore, grass-fed, fatty part, and that what preserves this energy-producing system that we are talking about most efficiently. And the longest.
So, Laszlo, let's take this opportunity, if you don't mind, like a little break, because the audience, whether they watch it now or later, a lot of my audience is a religious audience. They are, you know, they believe in God. I laugh because of the conversation we had before about evolution theory. But anyway, that's for another time. I'm just, at least half of the people here, they believe in God and they believe in the Bible. And I know from you, and that's another field of investigation for you, which is obviously related to mitochondria, that in the Bible, it's written, it says, what's the proper diet for us to have? And when I found out about it from you, I was like, wow, you know, because it's quite amazing because you look at the Bible, I mean, apart from believing in God, you look at the Bible from the eyes of a biochemist. And this is fascinating. So if you can just let us, you know, for a couple of minutes, just take us sure. to your eyes to see the proper diet as it's written in the Bible.
Sure. Now, well, I think this is the most important nutritional guideline that you can get from the Torah, from the Old Testament, mm-hmm. or for that matter, if you look at Paleo-Hebrew writings, because the book of Job and the five books of Moses, those are also in the Qumran rolls. They also found Paleo-Hebrew writings or manuscripts from these books, Job and the five books of Moses. And if you look at the Genesis or Bereshit, if I pronounce it right, which is the first book.
You just did, yes.
The first book of Moses. God puts man on a vegetarian diet. So all the plants, all the seeds, all the nuts, and that's the first dietary recommendation. I think it's Bereshit part 1, verse 29-30. I believe if you guys use the same numbering as, because I use the Old Testament, unfortunately, I don't speak Hebrew. So,
not yet, soon.
Not yet, but listen, I'm trying. You know, I admire so much you because you speak Hebrew.
I know.
Don't laugh at it. You're always laughing. It's just such a very, very rich source of all these ancient knowledges and scriptures and texts. But actually, God realizes very early, first of all, Adam means red light, if I'm correct, in Hebrew. So the name of Adam. Yeah. Say it again.
Yeah, it's yes. Adam is also Adam. It's red.
Yeah, yeah. You see, that's where you take your advantage. You see, I just learned these things from others. So practically, God knows that first of all, in the Garden of Eden, they cannot eat a fruit which is in the middle of the garden, but it's plant-based fruit. And we know what happens when they eat them. They both get crazy and they start acting like very, like funny in the sense that they show fear. They start lying. They start blaming each other and God for all their mishaps. And they fall in the hands of the Satan. Mm-hmm. Now, the Lord sees that actually these dietary recommendations may not be the appropriate ones as far as plant-based diets. So he changes the dietary recommendation when Noé is walking off the ark and his family with all the animals after the flood, the big flood. And God instructs them to actually eat meat. And it comes back several times in Old and New Testament to actually change the nutrition from plant-based to meat-based. And from then on, once Noé, as a religious man, obeys these laws, he promises him that he's not going to destroy the earth again, meaning that it seems like based on religious studies, based on the Torah, based on the text, and I did call my friend who is from Israel here in Hungary, and I asked her that what is the recommendation to Noé to eat plants and meat or just eat meat after all? And she said, based on the Hebrew text, is to replace plant-based diet with a carnivore meat-based diet, and it's not eating both. So practically, if we look at God's work and God's plan, and those are commands from by God what to eat. It's actually nutrition is the most important and the number one intervention by God to fix problems with humanity. And if you look at the story of Adam and Eve, you can tell their sons, Cain and Abel. Cain kills Abel, the meat producer, the plant, the agriculture guy. Cain kills Abel, and God knows that he sees that basically something is going really not very well, so he needs to change the diet. After all, from plant-based to meat-based, carnivore.
But even then, it's just grass-fed meat.
Yeah, and grass-fed meat. God never said that you should actually feed your cow anything other than what they eat naturally. He only gives dietary recommendations to humans what to eat and never to the animals. Animals are created in a way and named by the first, because pretty much naming, and if I understand the Torah right or the historic Jewish culture, naming species or naming somebody meaning pretty much like taking in control, meaning that taking care of those creatures, like assuming ownership of some sort. And I know this from my religious professor friend who teaches religion at the College of Szeged. Because we talk with friends, with one of the Hungarian rabbis, and from rabbis and with rabbis from Israel. Also, we cover these topics because I really would like to read and understand what's and why those commands by God are implemented and are preserved in in the Torah, and why copying the Torah is such a strict process so none of this information would be lost for generations. And I think this is the most amazing service that the Jewish people, the Jewish religion provides for us. That is practically to preserve this information till the end of times. And this is why the religious copying of these holy books, authenticated Torahs, is just such a rigorous process. And I think the purpose of that is to preserve these dietary recommendations to fix problems in humanities and societies and communities and so on. And that brings us exactly to where we are with this paper, to mitochondria, which I would like to cover before we finish our podcast. And say it again.
Back with the picture.
Yeah, back with the picture. So once the fatty acids are transferred to mitochondria, mitochondria has these double membranes with these ATP synthase nanomotors, and that's where the real stuff happens. But since there are spinning proteins in mitochondria, deuterium is not really desired simply because it's twice as heavy, twice as large as protons, and they may break these ATP synthase nanomotors. But anyhow, you can see on the top of the mitochondria, the TCA cycle, which is the Sandor-de-Krebs cycle or the tricarboxylic acid cycle, and it produces carbon dioxide, H2O, water, and reduced NAD, NADH, which is the ultimate complete biological oxidation of any substrate. It's not hydrogen peroxide, but it's water. It's not shorter chain fatty acids and ketone bodies, but it's actually carbon dioxide that you can breathe out. So you can actually get rid of carbons. So, and in the meantime, 286 kilojoules per mole energy is produced when water is produced from oxygen and hydrogen of food, which is a very substantial amount of energy. You can see this with the letter D on top. And in the bottom, you can see the oxidative phosphorylation in the very bottom in green. background, you can see that 21 kilojoule per mole of ATP-related energy is produced also while these protons are powering these ATP synthase nanomotors without the presence of deuterium. So these two cell organelles are producing the ultimate amount of energy that is needed to climb up to the Mount Everest. And it's really interesting in the sense that it seems like God, and I'm going back to the Torah or the religious studies, God gave us this planet to actually care for it and put a mountain on top of it, or put a mountain to climb that that can actually, with the appropriate diet, be the carnivore diet, that actually you can actually climb up to the top of it, you know, only if you consume a carnivore, only if you consume the diet that he gave to Noah. And apparently the size of this planet has to be measured, which is in the book of Job, because God asked Job that who measured the size of Earth, who actually used the kind of the measuring rope over it, because it can only have a certain certain mass, Earth. It's about 10,000 kilometer in diameter. It's about 6,000 kilometers radius. So it's about 12,000 kilometers. So this size of a planet has sufficient gravitation, but it also has electromagnetic kind of forces that can actually work in any living species as far as electron transport chain, proton movement, the weight, the mass of deuterons or deuterium. So the gravitational, the electromagnetic forces are optimally designed on this planet. And indeed, with the right diet, we can control and we can climb up all the way to the top of Mount Everest. And God even gave us this exercise path just to try different dietary options. And sure enough, if you're on a plant-based carbohydrate diet, you will not make it up there. So it seems like it's a very interesting scenario that is explained in our paper by the crosstalk of peroxisomes and mitochondria. And this paper also has the energy scales that you gain from this approach. So if you're interested in sports, I wouldn't say religion at this point, because there are no religious or ancient transcripts discussed in this paper. But if you want to expand your knowledge in that area, you want to look in the book of Genesis, Bereshit, and you can find the appropriate sections based on what we discussed here and based on the laws and the rules God set for us as far as nutrition is concerned. But it's practically a deuterium depleting grass-fed animal-based diet is that allows us to perform at our highest, I would say, mental and physical abilities, which are both necessary to, first of all, understand religious scriptures or any scriptures, be wise enough and be smart enough to stay away from Satan, which is fruit and high fructose and corn syrup and plant-based stuff. And in the meantime, to understand God's word, that's wisdom practically. And this is also discussed in the book of Job. So details need to be added from the natural sciences point of view to understand the scriptures and the Bible better.
So basically, we were talking about this extreme example of climbing Mount Everest. But actually, all fields of sports, when sportsmen actually start to change their diet to follow this diet of grass-fed animal products, most likely, I mean, we can assume that results in whatever respective sports they are doing or activate themselves in, their results will get much better.
Because if you take so sports is about competition. It can be high attitude as you're competing against, or it can be another sportsman who is better prepared based on diet and oxygen supply. So sports is always at peak performance, you know, certain level of sports, meaning that if it's competitive and you're a professional, then you need to consider these. I'm not talking about, you know, just kind of just exercise type sports, but I'm talking about competitive sports. And in general medicine, because in obesity, in diabetes, in neurodegenerative diseases, in metabolic syndrome, and the list is long and goes on, and this is discussed in the paper, they all benefit from better oxygen use and better energy production, cellular level energy production. So, excuse me. So all fields of medicine, sports medicine and internal medicine could benefit, and integrative medicine and chiropractors and alternative approaches, they all can benefit from this information as far as how to gain the most efficient energy from cellular metabolism using dietary approaches, and those have to be grass-fed animal-based fat to be oxidized with low deuterium to perform at the highest peak that we can achieve.
Excellent. Thank you very much for that, Laszlo. It's been a pleasure. It's always a pleasure. Let us book, maybe not now, but just to remind you, let's do a podcast about theory of evolution and what it's all about, you know, and God versus God. I think it can be quite interesting. Meanwhile, thank you very much for your time and for your knowledge to share with us. I hope this podcast will bring benefits to those who listen to it, because, you know, the more I work on the field of biohacking and doing all these hacking things to improve my performance and to improve energy production in the body and water production in the body, I find more and more things who can actually contribute to that, make things easier, make processes shorter even, and to gain more benefits from what I do. So, and some of it is thanks to you. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you so much. Thanks for inviting me. Sure. We'll schedule another one shortly. Yeah.
Yes, we would. Thank you very much, and God bless us all.
Thank you so much. Bye.
All the best. Bye-bye.